You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to the 9 millionth edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and today is Wednesday, November 10th, 2021. I am fully back to 100%. This has taken a while, but now I am tremendously inspired. There's so many things. I'm going to be all over the place. I have so many things I want to do. I have two books. I have 9 trillion articles. There's so much going on. And today we're going to talk about something that when I was the editor of the Barnes Review many years ago, I received a letter to the editor that asked about this. In fact, not only that, I received a phone call. And the topic is, the Third Rome had just come out, and it's Tsar Alexander and the legend of Saint Fyodor Kuzmich. That is to say, Alexander Pavlovich, or the Emperor Alexander I. This is the grandson of Catherine. Now, some of you may be aware of this, but there is a theory that does have some credibility that the emperor, Alexander I of Russia, ruling in the first part of the 19th century, abdicated secretly and became a wandering monk named the Fyodor Kuzmich, who now is Saint Fyodor Kuzmich. Now, his canonization back in 1984 had nothing to do with this idea, and the official biography doesn't mention it. But it's a theory that's been around a long time. There's a couple of issues, and some of these we've dealt with before. My lecture on Tsar Paul, now actually Saint Paul the Emperor. There's only one, so you don't have to worry about that. Who was murdered by the oligarchs in order to make way for Tsar Alexander. He's repenting of this. Also, in his toleration of liberalism and Freemasonry in the beginning of his reign, he had an extremely sensitive nature, and he abdicated, or so the story goes, and he became a monk. The evidence for it is decent, but not overwhelming. But unfortunately, that's often how history is. So much of the evidence in these cases is second-hand or even third-hand. And as always, you read the Anglo-American historians, they simply dismiss it. They don't even know what a wandering monk is. They don't even realize that most monarchs in Russian history have become monks at the time of their death. At least that was a pre-Petrine notion. It was not uncommon. Certainly not like this. And as a result, they simply dismiss it and usually don't even mention it. Well, Leo Tolstoy did believe it. And a lot of serious writers at the time accepted the idea. And it's not an unpopular theory in Russia. And it's sort of a big deal that an emperor can simply do this. Remember, this is before you had, photography, certainly before any kind of electronic surveillance, before the internet, obviously, before any of this radio and TV, it's much easier to pull this off, even if you're an emperor. It's extremely difficult. You imagine how it is to live in a society where, you know, you can't be followed around, you can't be tracked everywhere, and what that would mean, both good and bad, for everybody involved. So, allegedly, 10 years after the alleged death of the emperor, in 1825, roughly 10 years later, news began to come trickle out of Siberia that he was still alive, that the emperor was still alive, and he was in Tomsk under the name of the elder Fyodor Kuzmich. There were many people in the Romanov family who accepted this idea well, especially at the time. It's a strange story. And it seems that as he, at a certain point, he got ill, went to Taganrog, down on the Sea of Azov, not a bad place at all, along with his wife and an entourage to get better. And his health was improving substantially, and he died. From there, the story is very strange. And we're going to get to that here in a minute. Roughly around this time, a bit later on, Fyodor, St. Fyodor now, appears out of nowhere. Absolutely with no backstory, in a small Siberian village, and would not answer any questions about his past. Only mentioning his name. What got people interested was that he claimed to be illiterate, but spoke several languages. He did bear a striking resemblance to the emperor, but that, you know, wasn't in and of itself remarkable. And he not only he became a teacher, this wandering monks back then, if they were legitimate, they had, you know, you wander into a village, you show that you are a true Orthodox, and you had sponsors. This is how it went. You know, having Rasputin as a confidant of the royal family, for example, was not crazy. It isn't what anyone thinks it is. But, you know, aristocrats and merchants usually would sponsor a wandering monk as a teacher and an advisor. This was not uncommon. And so as Fyodor went from place to place, he was able, although he lived at the absolute level of destitution, did have those protecting him. And when he went to different places, he wandered around. Somehow, despite being illiterate, was able to teach history, geography, grammar, and theology. Again, not to mention speaking numerous languages. Wherever he went, he became very popular. Now, Alexander I, or Alexander Pavlovich, if you believe the official story, he died in 1825, if not, 1864. Now, some of you know what I think of his grandmother, Catherine II, as a tormentor of the church, as was everyone in that era except Elizabeth. Now, of course, Paul was a great man. Catherine hated her son Paul, and he was murdered by the oligarchs that had gathered around her. Now, Paul was very pious. He took measures against liberalism and Freemasonry, which at the time was one and the same things. The oligarchs had noble titles, and he wanted to force them back into service rather than simply being idle oligarchs. The rationale for having an aristocratic class as the property-owning group, meaning productive capital, was that they had to serve, and it could be very dangerous, usually military, sometimes bureaucratic. You didn't get this stuff for nothing. But thanks to the those like Catherine and the oligarchs that came before her, that service requirement was eliminated. So now they had no responsibilities, and yet they had peasants working for them. Paul wanted to reverse this. And this is why the British government, along with the oligarchs there, revolted. And in a conspiracy, the great Emperor Paul was murdered in 1801. And it had the tacit consent of Alexander. And he was misled. He was lied to about what Paul was doing, as are most students in American universities. And after his father was murdered, Alexander said that he was going to rule according to the laws of Catherine, canceled everything that Paul had done, brought the oligarchs, and surrounded him with that. Remember, oligarchy at the time in Russia meant, or sorry, liberalism, it's always oligarchy, of course. Liberalism also meant an increase in serfdom. You had liberal groups who wanted serfdom abolished. That was just so they can work the factories for far less. That's all that meant. But liberal reforms at the time meant that the nobility received greater power over their serfs. The last thing in the universe liberals wanted was peasants who hated them to have any power. Alexander did permit peasants to redeem themselves by free agreement with landowners, but that wasn't very popular. And the peasantry was given the legal right to own land outright rather than strictly the commune. And he starts off, Alexander starts off as a so-called liberal reformer, and it doesn't last. And it comes, of course, from the thing that he's most famous for, Alexander's defeat of Napoleon. Alexander was sponsoring, thanks to his grandmother, liberal groups in Russia. But usually with these guys, they're very naive. They take the left at their word. They really believe that they accept, you know, equality under the law and all that, having no idea the economic and religious background of all of this. The minute he began to support, you know, Masonic groups and liberal organizations that came from it, of course, always the elite, often in military circles, they conspired immediately against him. And once he got wind of this, he changed his attitude. Among other things, after the war with Napoleon, his understanding of the French Revolution, everything that came from it, he not only defeated this, but helped create the Holy Alliance and bringing people like Commander Iphotius close to him and rejecting liberalism. It's one of the things. In 1822, Alexander bans secret societies and Freemasonry. And just a year later, he instructed the police to identify conspirators. Now, when I say police, I'm talking about the handful of law enforcement connected to his person, connected to the office of monarch, that kept watch on the oligarchs, kept watch on the higher levels of the aristocracy. This is what secret police meant in old Russia. It was something that was given teeth by Nicholas I, who of course came to power after Alexander abdicated. So, after the war with Napoleon, Alexander changed his point of view. People like Archimandrite Photius, these zealot ascetics were resisting oligarchy. This is what they were doing, what liberals were claiming to do. And the more he began to fight Freemasonry, the more popular he became. So, at some point here, we're talking about, of course, 1825, whether there's evidence that Alexander abdicated, faked his death, and wandered around as Fyodor. Now, the official story is that when he went, you know, he traveled for his health, which, by the way, not entirely sure what was going on. With it, what was the matter with him? That's, you know, for for a bureaucratic apparatus around the monarch that was extremely strict about these kind of things. We have no idea what was really happening. But he was on a brief pilgrimage to the monastery of St. George in the Crimea, the one that's carved into a rock. He caught a serious cold, or, you know, we call a cold. And it was the monastery was damp, and it was, you know, at the time, this is, you know, the worst place as far as the humidity is concerned. And and he had been feeling unwell for several days. He had an army of doctors there, and very quickly, by November, November 18th is one of the milestone dates. This is when the doctor said there's no hope of saving this man. Apparently, he died in agony, very painful, November 19th. But there's a lot of problems with this. The Empress Maria said, yes, this is my dear son, Alexander. But a few hours earlier, the coffin arrived in the capital. The head of the procession stated, the severe decay turned the sovereign's face into a black and green mask, distorting features beyond recognition. Which is very strange, which is why the testimony of Maria doesn't make, it has no value there. Where the body went is more or less unknown. 1921, the Bolsheviks opened this, by the way, the mausoleum is extremely large and very heavy. There's some evidence that his body was not there. And there's actually a number of first-hand accounts of this. Most of them, however, are second and sometimes third-hand. The records of Count of Volonsky, who was with the Tsar until his death, are full of contradictions. There's all kinds of problems with this. Prince Bryansky, very famous researcher about Kuzmich and his connection here, is absolutely convinced that this is not the same man. And this is, you know, a sergeant major of the Life Guards Regiment. They claimed, at one point, they claimed that this was what they call the old French disease, or syphilis. But this wasn't true. In fact, no one knows what's going on. D.K. Tarasov, who was connected to one of the surgeons here, he signed the death certificate. Then Professor I.T. Tarasov, his nephew, said that the sovereign was a man of holy life, didn't talk about the day of death, did not accept the syphilis theory. And he didn't do memorial services as a pious man until after 1864. Then he served them all the time. 1864 is when Fyodor Kuzmich died, Fyodor of Tomsk. Right away, you have a lot of problems here. We don't know anything about this man, as I said before, up until the time that the emperor allegedly died. The first time we come across him is on September 4th, 1836, in Perm, in the far north. A wandering monk show, which was not the craziest thing in the world, although the problem was vagrancy was often connected to the old believers, especially the priestless sects. So you see a wandering vagrant, long beard, looking vaguely monastic, but clearly not connected to a monastery. He shows up out of nowhere, and it was actually a local blacksmith who contacted the authorities. And he was tall, about 60. He had lashes on his back, so clearly he had been in trouble at some point. He had no documents, and because of that, he was arrested. He was then interrogated. He said that he was an Orthodox, illiterate man, did not even remember anything about his young life. Because of his lack of documents, he was exiled to Tomsk. Strangely enough, he was one of the only ones anyone could remember that was not restrained with shackles, which is kind of a big deal at the time. Now, anytime he was asked to sign something or write anything, he claimed to be illiterate. He had other people doing it for him. Everyone now knows that he was very well educated, but he was very worried about giving any sample of his handwriting to the authorities. His handwriting has been successfully analyzed, and there is definitely a similarity. St. Theodore lived a rigorous life. He slept on a board. He wore the simplest of clothes. And yet he was extremely charismatic. Everyone loved this guy. But he carried himself as an aristocrat. He carried himself as a man who knew the capital. He knew those around the capital. He knew those around the monarch as if he was living it. And he has a strange quote, and this has a few sources. He was asked about his life. And there's numerous times people were asking about his previous life. And finally, one day, he says this. And this is a rough translation here. Kind of impatiently, he says, "Why do you think that my situation now is worse than it was before?" Now, he's saying this, of course, because he's living a very ascetic life. People are getting the impression that he's not who he says he is. Then he says, "Right now, I'm free, I'm independent. My life is easy in that respect. My peace and happiness depend, in the past, depending on many conditions. I had to take care of my loved ones. I wanted to make sure they were as happy as I am. I wanted to make sure my friends didn't deceive me. There was nothing of this, except what remained with me, the words of God. The only thing that remains, the love of Savior and neighbor. Now I have no grief and disappointment. I don't depend on anything earthly. Anything that isn't in my power. You do not understand what happiness is. This is freedom of the spirit, unearthly joy. If you restore me to my former position and make me again the guardian of earthly well, perishable, now altogether unnecessary, I would be an unhappy man. The more our body is pampered and groomed, the more our spirit becomes weak. Every luxury relaxes our body and weakens our soul." And the very fact that he was able to speak like this is where the rumors began. Too many things were coming together. Now, I translated that passage myself, but sometimes it's not a great idea. And the best I could come up with is when he says, "depending on anything earthly, depending on anything that's not in my power." Now he's talking about connection to land, a connection to money, whatever it is. "He would restore me to my former position and make me again the guardian of earthly wealth. I'm 90% sure I have that right. That's the issue. Make me again the guardian of earthly wealth. I would be miserable." Suggesting that he was very powerful. He didn't like it, because power is extremely difficult, and he abandoned something. His grave, when St. Theodore died, he received visitors of the highest rank in society. Tsar Nicholas II was one, and of course Alexander III, his father, another one. And by the way, you know, there's a rumor that the mausoleum was opened 4 times. The Soviets opened it and used it as a toilet. This is something that they did quite often. Which again, that Judaic obsession with bodily fluids. You see it all over the Talmud. But even that, what was in there has always been debated. You need a lot of equipment to open up one of those grave sites. In this case, of course, in Petersburg. It was Innocent of Alaska is one. The famous bishop, Father Peter Popov, Bishop Athanasius of Irkutsk in Siberia, all said that Kuzmich knew French especially and spoke about St. Petersburg and Moscow and the regional capitals as if he and even, you know, prominent people as if they were his friends. One of the big pieces of evidence here is that St. Fyodor Kuzmich discussed in detail with Metropolitan Filaret intimate details about the War of 1812. There was no claim or belief that he was in the army or anything like that. He didn't carry himself that way. By this time, there was already rumors starting here. Now, there is a third-hand account that on his deathbed, the priest asked, "Are you, in fact, Tsar Alexander?" And he said, quote, "Your works are wonderful, O Lord. There is no secret which is not to be opened." Not 100% sure what that is, but he's being very mysterious. And wherever he went, the first place, near Tomsk, a village that he settled in after his exile, there was a Cossack, Semyon Sidorov, that built him a small, again, they sponsor these guys. He proved himself not just a holy man, but a great teacher. And he said to him, the Cossack said to him, "You really need to possess rare qualities and have a brilliant past in order to arouse his general attention and respect here in Siberia." That also was repeated by researcher Vasilich. And strangely, Kuzmich, without making any real effort, without putting on an act or really doing much of anything, he became popular even almost nationwide. He reached a position where even generals and bishops never received. He was a man of national significance. Beginning of the 20th century, in the house of Sidor, of course, they were long gone by then. There was a portrait of Tsar Alexander in a large card that Fyodor Kuzmich has his handwriting. One of the very positive, definite examples of his handwriting. So not only do you have a handwriting connection, you have a physical connection. And this comes up over and over again. Cossack Berezin, who did serve in St. Petersburg for a time, came to visit Sidorov. He saw Kuzmich, and he gasped and almost cried, saying, "This is the emperor." And not only did Kuzmich leave, this, of course, was a lot, not only did he leave, he started to pack up. This has happened more than once. Whenever he came across, because he was getting more prominent than he wanted to be, whenever anyone from Petersburg would show up, he would disappear. Kuzmich was recovering from a hospital, an illness in the hospital. And a nobleman who had been acquainted with the emperor came to his room, paid his respects, and Kuzmich immediately hid his face, which is he's never done before. When workmen, sometimes, of course, he's not a perfect man. He got angry. There was a lot of workmen near his home and made a lot of noise, were acting uncivilized. He got angry, and he said, "If you knew who I was, you would be much, much quieter." That's just, obviously he's not a perfect man, but, these are the things, again, secondhand, though. Evidence that when you put it all together is extremely powerful. There's a local girl there named Alexandra, who was a student of Kuzmich. And she told him about, she wanted to go to St. Petersburg. And yet he then, here's another example, he vividly describes a city to her, although he claims to have never been there. And when she returned, Alexandra told Fyodor that he looked exactly like Tsar Alexander's portrait. And Dr. Tarasov, as I mentioned before, a few others, Count Ostensakin, he were at the autopsy of the emperor, alleged autopsy of the emperor, did not go to the funeral. It's odd. These were men very close to him, part of the court circle, and yet never showed up. Dr. Tarasov, as I mentioned already, wrote in his memoirs that he held a shocking secret that he would carry to his grave. Alexander III, my favorite more modern Russian monarchs, had a portrait, or an icon. I shouldn't say an icon, he was only canonized in 84, but clearly a venerable picture of Kuzmich on his desk. And I mentioned already that his son Nicholas went to his gravesite. But actually, when he was much younger, he was still heir to the throne. When the Grand Duchess Olga, who was the daughter of Alexander III, was asked about, you know, Kuzmich's real identity, she told her biographer, her official biographer, that it was widely accepted among her family that Alexander faked his death and became a monk, but it was not discussed. I mentioned Leo Tolstoy. He doesn't seem to have an interest one way or the other, but he was a devotee of this theory. And I'm quoting from a posthumous notes of the Starets Fyodor Kuzmich, which he wrote, which isn't quoted very much, but it's certainly Tolstoy. He says, after the monk's death, he's talking about Fyodor, of course, after the monk's death, rumors only spread and became strong. Not only common people believed them, but many from the elite, including the royal families or Alexander III. The reasons for the rumors were this. Alexander died unexpectedly. He suffered from no disease before. He died far away from home in a remote place, Taganrog. And when he was put in the coffin, many who saw him said he changed a lot. And this is why the coffin was quickly sealed. It was known that Alexander said and wrote that he wanted very much to leave his post and stay away from this world. Now that's what Tolstoy said, and he accepted it. And it's true, over and over again, Alexander wanted to retire. He wanted to get out of there. Political scientists have a tendency to believe that people want power. That people, if you're a politician, you're a general, whatever you are, you will act in such a way as to gain more power. This is how it's like a businessman with money. But even that's not true. It just isn't the case. Someone, a dictator passes a law, and you say, well, that just gives him more power. Now, the assumption is that power is a good thing. That power is automatically a good thing. Power isn't. Power is a huge amount of work and a crushing responsibility. I'm immediately reminded of Bashar Assad in Syria, a man who was a successful doctor. His brother Basil was killed in a car accident. And now, you know, he had a successful practice in Britain. He now had to take over. And of course, it's very popular, partially because he didn't want it. Power is crushing. Now, I mentioned the analysis, Svetlana Simonova. And she is a president of the Russian Graphological Society. She does make the claim that what I mentioned, writing of Fyodor and Alexander I are very similar. It's hard to be definitive because our handwriting does change. Mine certainly has. I went from actually having pretty neat Catholic school handwriting to squiggles. It looks like Arabic, except I don't dot anything. And that just comes from, you know, doing so much work. Her analysis is actually pretty substantial. And again, as far as the Anglo-American establishment is concerned, completely rejected. But there's so many of these examples. I always thought one of the best evidence is that while no one knew who he was, no one had any concept except for the rumors, he knew not only Petersburg, but he knew the offices in Petersburg. He knew the War of 1812. He knew these things intensely. Father John Alexdronsky, exiled to Siberia for something from the Synod. And he saw the Tsar many times and claimed that Fyodor Kuzmich was Alexander I. A lot of people, who certainly people who knew both, either didn't say a word or at some time or another said that this is the same man. Even though It's a very different world back then. You can pull, you couldn't pull, you know, you have a controlled media now. So it may not be as difficult to do it now, but you're always going to have these rumors. You don't see this, you see, you know, Jim Morrison sightings and all this other nonsense. Here you have, you know, this consistent problem. Every aspect of the official story is problematic. And whenever Kuzmich was identified, he ran away. He did not seek after any kind of, I mean, he didn't want to be monarch in the first place. And again, assuming it's the same person, he didn't want adulation to be the center of attention under any circumstances. I mean, you can see this, you know, the illiterate, how many people say, well, I thought he was an illiterate, simple monk, and he's speaking French. And he knows the treaties between different countries. If he were a prominent man in Petersburg, he would have been identified. But there's no one else that he could have been. And Athanasius of Irtush, as I mentioned already, has testified to a lot of this. Yes, of course, objectively, they're very difficult to prove. It should be noted, too, that Kuzmich kept an icon of Alexander Nevsky, which was one of his prized possessions. He kept it very close. And that was, of course, the emperor's patron. And certainly his favorite Russian saint, which makes a lot of sense. And on that day, that was the one time that Kuzmich would allow himself to break his fast and the ascetic rule a little bit. I mean, he talked about 1812, you know, the war against Napoleon. He reported details of such a level, not details that a soldier would have, or even a mid-level officer would have, but someone commanding from Petersburg. You know, exiles, you know, priests, Cossacks, soldiers, officers of all types. He knew who went where. It was, you know, like Arkhiev, the Suvorov, Kutuzov. You know, Fyodor Kuzmich said that Tsar Alexander was jealous of Kutuzov and explained in depth how he was appointed commander-in-chief of the war, of the Russian forces against Napoleon. He said in one of the few preserved quotes on this, Fyodor Kuzmich said, "When the French approached Moscow, Emperor Alexander fell to the relics of Sergius of Radonezh and prayed for a long time with tears to this saint. This time he heard an inner voice say, 'Go, Alexander, give full freedom to Kutuzov, and may God help expel the French from Moscow.'" That's a very odd thing to say. He wasn't claiming to make any kind of a prophecy or anything else. There's no way to know that. And he wasn't the type to tell these stories. I mean, he never did that anywhere else. And maybe it was just an unguarded moment. But this is, you know, this is clearly evident. There's a book out. The book in English that should be taken seriously is from Alexis Trubetskoy. This is a member of the family, born in Paris in 1934. He comes from that, you know, same princely family. And he immigrated to the U.S. and then to Canada. And he retired in 1993. He is as serious as you're going to get in this regard. And it's probably the best book out there. And it's probably... Now, of course, this is Trubetskoy. This isn't your typical Anglo-American historian. But he seems to accept the idea. For example, and he has several arguments. I can only summarize them. Listen, I have a dog here who wants to play. So if he gives, you know, I have animals everywhere for some reason. So you hear him, hear her. Just, you know, I'm just a very loved person. Anyway, the access to the tomb. It was denied, you know, anyone to work on it. And without any good reason. that was opened a handful of times, and even that's iffy. That was a Igor Lavrentiev, who was a soldier of the Peter and Paul Fortress, you know, a former guardsman. So that means that he actually had some prominence. The well-known psychiatrist named Ivan Belinsky is the source of this. Lavrentiev said that he was present, I believe it was 1866, where the mausoleum was actually opened, one of the rare times. He says that he was given 10,000 silver rubles to keep quiet because it was empty. This is not the only, he's not the only person to say this. He's not the only person to say that it was empty. When he, well, again, being a guardsman, reaching the upper ranks, he did have, you know, aristocratic patrons. His death actually mattered. And then someone similar, Countess Suvalova, who was a daughter of Count Vorontsov Dashkov, who was former viceroy in the Caucasus, said that her father also was paid to be quiet after Alexander III had the had it open. So now you have two people. I mentioned the psychiatrist, Belinsky. He was at his bedside as this soldier died. He had no reason to lie. And it came up because this guy, despite being fairly high in rank, had, you know, this money and had assets that he bought with this money. I mean, it mattered. He mentions it. And so what the heck does this come from? And that's the story he told. No reason to lie about it. And Countess Suvalova, this comes from her diary. So these things aren't just some lunatic. You know, when any sovereign, certainly sovereigns of Russia, but any European monarch in Europe at the time, when they die, there's a very, very strict protocol. Every detail is recorded absolutely meticulously and by the right people, designated authorities. It doesn't matter where, it's weird that he was so far away. But even then, you have people who are then put in charge. You had a large entourage. You have documents signed by witnesses, which are sealed and deposited in the archives. The time of death is recorded. Those who are there are, ultimately, every word and gesture is recorded. There's nothing that's left out. Every movement as death approaches. And certainly at this point, 1825, you had advanced medicine, you had the best doctors, and you had a very strict protocol, and none of this was followed. That by itself, that anything else, is extremely suspicious. There's also a claim. There, people who are witnesses claim, this is all very informal, that he died in great pain. I mentioned this already. But there are several other witnesses that don't mention it. Talk about his, you know, peacefully giving up his soul, or something like that. He had made a turn, as I mentioned, to Orthodoxy, starting off as a, you know, student of his grandmother, because of Napoleon and the Masonic conspiracies against him and against the crown in general. He turned on. He became very strict in his Orthodoxy. He did not call for a priest. He did not call for last rites. In fact, no one around him did. That is an extremely convincing argument that this man did not die and had no intention of dying. In addition to this, and this is from Trubetskoy's book, but it's in the Russian sources too. He wasn't immediately brought to the church. Again, this is part of the protocol. Whatever the cathedral is, if it's not in the capital, there's a very specific timeline, and there was a long delay. Depending on who, it's roughly 36 hours. And that's absolutely inexcusable under these conditions. And it's not just one area is sloppy. It was all sloppy. The signatures are inconsistent. The few documents that remain, including, not only are they on, they're claiming they're there, they're not there, like Tarasov is a big one, says he was there and wasn't. Others, the opposite. And they're on one document, they're not on the other. Now, usually there'd be this book worth of documents, but that's not the case here at all. Nothing is adding up. What we have of the, not even, it's not an autopsy, it's a report of some kind. It makes reference to a discoloration, I think is the term, of one leg. Sometime earlier, a horse had kicked him in the left leg, and he always struggled with this. He always had pain, there was damage done. And it was, you know, almost well known among people who knew him. And 1824, the wound became infected and he got a fever. But, you know, it was okay. And Tarasov was the person who attended to it. But then became permanently discolored because of that. Tarasov, in his memoirs and elsewhere, says the wound is on his left leg, which of course is where it was. The so-called autopsy report and several other supporting documents say it's on the right. And you know, what is an autopsy? Really, the sole purpose of an autopsy is to ascertain the cause of death, both the proximate cause and the causes before that. But that's the only thing it really doesn't do here. It uses the most vague language for an advanced signed a medical establishment, which you had in 1825. Phrases like taken by an extreme illness. Phrases like a rush of blood. Fierce fever. Mentioning disease, just abstractly, as the cause of death of His Imperial Majesty. And there is no cause of death mentioned. Going through the symptoms that are recorded, even those are inconsistent. It can only be a few things. A few people have said food poisoning. One said malaria because he was down in the southern region. A few people said typhus. Early on, it was syphilis, which is ridiculous under the circumstances. And because of that, if you go through these, okay, now I have a cat coming on me. Who knows what they're going to do? This is not Stanley. This is Marcel, by the way. None of the symptoms are consistent with these things. The timeline isn't either. He did have oysters. Anyone who eats oysters raw has got something wrong with them. It's like eating mushrooms. But that was said to be a possibility. But none of the reported symptoms support any of this. They're too inconsistent, and the timeline is off. Another argument is, now this is something I know about from experience, 32 hours roughly is a delay. The body was very decomposed. When I grew up over a funeral home, I know a thing or two about this. I know about embalming. And the process, the chemicals are different, but the process isn't all that different. I'm sorry, you don't embalm. That's an American, you know, much later thing. You don't embalm for an Orthodox monarch. But the procedures, and how long this takes, and when do these problems set in, that I grew up with. And this doesn't make any sense. The only way that it could have been that bad off in 36 hours if the place was superheated. Princess Volkonsky writes her account diary. It says, the chemicals used for the preservation of the body totally darkened it. The eyes had sunk. It was from the nose that changed the most. Almost aquiline. Now, when it says preservation of the body, that is not the same thing as embalming, but they do treat it. And worse than that, they were smoking cigars, which is what these guys used to use back then to kill the smell. But 36 hours isn't enough time for this. And the princess here is talking about a different man. One of the ladies in waiting, Countess Edling, companion to Elisaveta, went down to Ganrog after his death. And it was on December 15th at this point, she wrote in her diary, "I could not bring myself to unveil his face. I knew it was disfigured. Those who were sufficiently curious assured me that it was unrecognizable." And even the Empress, late November, said, "I'm under the same roof with the dear mortal remains, but one doesn't see them. He is covered, and I don't wish to behold that dear face so badly decomposed. On the first day, he appeared as though he would arise and resume his habitual vivacity and movements. And now, what a cruel change. Where did it come from? How do you explain this virtual transfiguration?" They weren't in a place, and certainly, you know, this is November. They weren't in a place, they weren't in any time of year where this kind of decay could have set in so quickly. In fact, in, you know, even in the southern part of the Russian Empire, this is a great time of year to die because you don't have to worry about this too much. There's so many issues. It was, you know, they didn't have an open casket. Now, this was the tradition at the time. It was open, but he was completely covered. And even things like General Davich, who, once the Dowager Empress received news of her son's death, he asked the general for a report on the illness and everything that happened. And general composed a reply talking about the trip down the Crimea. And, you know, that's when he, you know, allegedly contracted this. And he's very thorough, very typical of the time. Step by step of everything. And he comments on his appearance, comments on his state of health, all kinds of notations on the weather, everything that he wore. And close to the date of death, he says he covered 20 miles on horseback. Didn't seem to bother him. It was warm for him, but he appeared unaffected. Now, that was from earlier. This is, we're talking late November, this is the bad weather. And the long ride seemed not to bother him. Despite the darkness and strong wind, he insisted on pressing forward. It was actually, he seemed full of pep and happiness, over and over again. That was composed on December 7th, and he's talking about earlier. But remember, he was going down there to recover from an illness, but he clearly wasn't sick. Quite the contrary, actually. Now, this is something I think that's very, very specifically Orthodox. That this man was so taken by grief at the fact that he was involved, at least in a tacit sense, with killing his father, who was a very good man, a saintly man, and involved in bringing masonry to the Russian Empire. Even Catherine went back and forth on that issue, although she knew she was empowering the oligarchs who immediately went to Mason. The truth is that that ruling class, that legitimate aristocracy, slowly began to be infected by this garbage. And this is what Alexander saw around him. Kuzmich had made this quote, "I was surrounded by people lying to me. I couldn't take it anymore." I mean, I'm paraphrasing. This is something very severe, that he saw the destruction that he, and then, you know, we talked about the 18th century on this show 100 times, that old Russia was being hollowed out. He played a role in that, and he tried to reverse it. Things changed a bit after the defeat of Napoleon. The French Revolution was finally damaged. Freemasonry, of course, always dedicated to the so-called emancipation of the Jews, which automatically meant the rule of the banks and oligarchs. because they, of course, had access to this huge network of liquidity that no one else could approach. So it meant their domination. In a large empire, like Austria, Russia, and even places like China at its height, that group of people who are the most, the group that's the most cohesive is the one that's going to rule. And he was well aware of this. He was well aware of the fact that so-called emancipation meant the rule of the Jews. And it was always the same thing. This is central to Freemasonry and therefore to liberalism. This is what he was repenting. The truth is that Masonry was dedicated to the destruction of the Holy Alliance. Now, with all the problems of the Holy Alliance, this was the bulwark against liberalism, oligarchy, and what we now call, usurious capitalism. Now, clearly, the revolt of the Decembrists in 1825, which was a Masonic, elite Masonic cult that, after his alleged death, fought against Nicholas taking over. And there's one issue, of course, that arises is that clearly, even if he did do this, and he probably did, this allowed the Decembrists to attempt to take over the country. And the Emperor Nicholas, then Nicholas I, just barely was able to pull it out. And it was an extremely difficult a situation, although he was very merciful to them. They never, call it a secret society, largely because they don't say what their agenda is. This anti-religious, this humanistic enlightenment, this neo-pagan religion of reason, its assault on the church, Judaization, Jewish bankers financed Freemasonry, became its members. I mean, Rothschild had his own lodge, making believe that this had some connection to Christianity. Masonic sources have supported and been a part of the bourgeois revolutions and then even later. And once it's reached its goal in the West, it reached its goal and it kind of lost its edge. But certainly in the East, it hadn't achieved its goal. Secret organizations were necessary, not because they were persecuted, they weren't, but because you didn't have the police force for that. They needed to be very careful with what they said. They didn't want people to know. And only a few people like Photius in the church were warning against it. Even the Holy Alliance itself, making the three Lutheran, Catholicism, and Orthodoxy essentially one and the same, politically speaking, was a problem. Although it's really hard to deny it was a political necessity under the circumstances of the post-revolutionary age. Jews immediately began, from the very beginning, took part in the creation of Freemasonry. The Temple of Solomon, their obsession with it. The pride, the materialism, the Cain, the builder of the Tower of Babel, King Solomon, the builder of the Temple, Hiram, all of these people. Mentioning these as off the top of my head concepts that come out of this movement. The building of the Temple of Solomon, which is the earthly paradise. After the French Revolution showed itself, even Catherine was well aware. Even prior to that, I should say, they were well aware of what happened. The revolutionary explosion exposed Masonry. Therefore, he was well aware of his role in this. But in abdicating, he permitted the Decembrists to attempt to take over. I don't know specifically what he was running from. He was running from, as far as anyone can tell, from the temptations of power. He was running from the possibility of assassination. He was very worried about, repenting his father and his role in bringing liberalism. the rise of yet another Napoleon, even locally, because the Decembrists were, he couldn't have known this, but he knew it at some level. The Decembrists were mostly military men. The elite, the officer corps, to a great extent, was infected with this. The upper levels of the aristocracy was infected with this. But Alexander was popular enough where abdicating became a problem. It was said that Constantine was a liberal, Nicholas was not. So the Masons wanted Constantine, bringing him in from Poland. So, and those were the two candidates for to succeed him. Alexander either didn't know this or was irresponsible in allowing them free rein by abdicating. Well, we don't know what was going through his mind. I can go on and on about all the quotations of him saying, I want to leave. I don't want this. And this is one of the reasons that the rumors exploded right away. He didn't make any, he wasn't shy about that. Power is not normally a good thing. It's crushing. It's devastating. And he was incredibly sensitive. It's conceivable he didn't think he really had what it took to maintain something what Nicholas had, or what Nicholas I had, or what Alexander III had. And who he's going up against. The Masonic press was just getting started with their propaganda and their attacks on the church. So, the argument here is that chances are Alexander did abdicate. It's hard to blame him, but there's a lot of problems with that. It is not a perfect argument. A lot of it is secondhand, but it's really hard to deny, and it has not gone away. Alexander and abdicating let loose forces that, to a great extent, it was irresponsible of him to abandon. But if he didn't think he could handle it, if he didn't think he, and you really can't blame him for that, but again, that was his mission, to abandon what was granted to him, even though it was illegitimate, he should really not have been there, it was a murder. That doesn't mean, though, he didn't have a role to play. That's a problem. And he must have known, he definitely knew what was out there. He didn't predict the Decembrists, but he knew what was out there. Anyway, thank you everyone for listening. I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.